Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
And welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. This is our weekly program covering arts and arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Our theme music you heard is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, regional art patron Mary Levan, and our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. If you'd like to find out more about leasing space in this historic building, please give Walt a call, 219-462-5821. I'd like to thank them for their generous support. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president, radio operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and is part of the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. That's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. Our program, along with all of our programs, are streaming live at wvlp.org. Art on the Air is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. Our shows are carried by Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., and you can hear them at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Our entire show archive can be heard at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. And make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Art on the Air, WVLP. Art on the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art on the Air and, of course, the WVLP station, we'd be happy to become part of the WVLP family anytime. Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there or at wvlp.org/support. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air and the whole WVLP family. And now for our Art on the Air spotlight, we welcome Meg Roman from the Miller Beach Arts District and millerbeacharts.org. That's located at 540 South Lake Street in Gary. Meg, welcome to Art on the Air spotlight.
Hi, Larry. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Aloha, Meg.
Tell us a little bit about, first of all, what you're doing there in Miller, and then some of the upcoming things you have going on.
Okay, well, we are a nonprofit, 99% volunteer arts organization, but we're also a community development corporation. So our mission is, a short version, is arts as a catalyst for economic development. So in addition to holding art events, we also do a lot of community things, such as renting our space for community meetings or fundraisers for other organizations. We also rent for birthday parties and weddings and things like that. And we get involved in anything that will help improve the community, such as the planned transit-oriented development happening alongside the South Shore train double-tracking. We have architects and other community people who have their hands in that. And we like to collaborate with lots of other organizations. What we've got coming, what we're in the middle of right now, is an artist residency, where we've got three artists that all grew up along Lake Michigan, and they all live currently in Traverse City and Saugatuck. So they were part of a show called Reconnect two summers ago, and they're primarily landscape artists. But this year, they're bringing something new. They're going to be going out into the community, the beaches, the trails, the dunes, and doing some quick studies, some drawings and sketches. And then they're coming back to our art center at 540 South Lake Street in the Miller neighborhood of Gary. And they've set up an artist studio there where they are actually creating monotype prints. And they've had to adjust their plans because of COVID. So instead of doing in-person classes and a large group demonstration, we're doing everything either virtually through Zoom or we have the benefit of having very large plate glass windows, so the artists will be inside their studio, and people can be standing on our newly paved and widened sidewalks in front of the gallery and either print alongside, because they're going to be providing kits for people to do that with all the materials they need, or just simply watch them as they do the work.
Meg, what are their names? Who are the artists?
Thank you for asking that. The name of the show is called Painters Printing, and the artists are Angela Messiah Saxon, who's actually a Miller resident, or not resident now. She grew up here, but she's since moved to Harbor City. And her friends, who are all full-time artists, Anne Corlett, who is in Saugatuck, and Royce Deans, who's in Traverse City.
Now, Meg, now that you Miller, I believe, along Lake Street there, that's all been refixed, and, you know, there was a lot of construction. Is that back kind of the normal?
Yeah, it's almost there. So this is the third summer of construction, which can be very confusing and actually has taken a big hit on a lot of the businesses, because they're all family-owned, unique. You know, there's no box stores or chains here. But people have pushed through, because we know there's a great end in sight. And this year is, I believe, the last of the major work. They've repaved the roads. They've put in wide sidewalks. So we're going to be able to take advantage of that and have, you know, maybe like cafe seating in front of the gallery for special events. And there's now a brand new bike path, right, that goes right in front of the gallery. So that's doing like the finishing touches this week.
We're going to be able to do the sand mandalas again, and it's a farmer's market open in Miller?
Great questions. Yes, the farmer's market is one of our offerings, and they are open. We had to make some changes, as everybody did. So, but they're fully going. They started a month late, and our hours are shorter. So they run every Sunday in the spring and summer. They're going to be going through, we may go through September this year. We're hoping that we can add September on as well. So the hours are 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we're encouraging people to do online orders, and we have curtailed some of our activities, so we're not having prepared food or our live music or our art vendors, but we're focusing on the organic produce. We've got freshly made local honey, artisan cheeses, and homemade bread, so people are really enjoying the opportunity to be outside and pick up some fresh, wholesome food right in their neighborhood.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful.
Not coming this year, but we hope to have them back next year. But that is an awesome,
it is
awesome,
it's
thing
so,
that they do.
It's fabulous.
Meg, real quickly, wrap up your location, everything and website, and how to get there, and hours of operation.
Okay. Also in September, we're doing a social justice exhibit. So that will all be on our website, which is millerbeacharts.org. We're also on Facebook at Miller Beach Arts, as well as Instagram and Twitter. And our address is 540 South Lake Street in the Miller neighborhood of Gary. Phone number is 773-822-8086. And we're open every weekend, Fridays and Saturday nights, 6 to 8 p.m. and Sundays, 2 to 4 p.m.
Okay, and that's Meg Roman from the Miller Arts. That's millerarts.org to find out information. Find them on Facebook, too. Thank you for being on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And welcome to Art on the Air. We have Valerie Giolo. She is a Boston-based vocalist, author, attorney, stroke awareness advocate, and a vocalist. She possesses a distinctive, lush, retro style, a song with modern rock edge that makes her unique in today's music world. Hey, Valerie, welcome to Art on the Air.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's great to be here.
Aloha, Valerie.
Well,
hi there.
First of all, we want to just talk about your your origin journey, like where you started from where you were to where you are now.
Sure. Well, I've been living in Boston, born and raised in Boston, and I became a lawyer in 97, and I've been singing my entire life with various, I started in school, and then I started to sing in various different bands, maybe rock or classic rock, funk, dance bands. Then I met Al Vega. He was a Boston jazz legend that everybody, you know, played from with everyone. When the stars like Billie Holiday and so forth, when they would come here, he would be their backing band. So it was really, he was wonderful. And he gave me the opportunity. I sang with his trio. He had a bunch of different singers, you know, in a rotation. And I was one of those singers. And he really taught me so much about performing and gigging and arranging songs and so forth. And I've been, you know, I decided to make a CD with him because at the time he was in his late 80s and I knew he wouldn't be around forever. And I'm so glad that I did. And I just love singing and I also love law, well, representing my clients during the day. So it was really a good match.
So Valerie, what was your impetus for becoming a lawyer? Was it a family profession?
No, not at all, actually. I just enjoyed it. I took a class in high school, actually, of all places. I took a class on just a general, it was like a, forget even the name of the class. It might have been, it just had a little bit of legal topics sprinkled in. It was like a social studies class. And then I decided, I said, hey, this is pretty good. And then I went to college for accounting just because I wanted something to be able to get me into law school, actually. So I really didn't have any plans to become an accountant or anything. And I wanted to use that as a springboard, and I enjoyed it. And I've been representing clients. Let me see. I've done bankruptcy, immigration, criminal defense. Right now, I'm a criminal appellate lawyer. That's what I'm doing. And I haven't done the other areas in quite some time. But I think it's definitely very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
And you're in partnership, I guess, with your husband, am I correct?
Yes, we do. We have a partnership north of Boston. Mm-hmm.
And how does that work out, you know, with you guys actually working and then living together?
Yes, well, it's really a very unique situation because my husband represents a lot of businesses and restaurants and so forth. So it's a very different area of law that he does, and he doesn't practice criminal defense at all. And we do have the office is near our home. It's very, you know, it doesn't take too long to drive there. And so it works out perfectly because we could either practice at home. And actually, we've been practicing at home for several months, or we can elect to go into the office. So
that's great. Now, how does the vocal things as it evolved? You talked a little bit about your origins of where that. As you developed your vocal style, tell us a little bit about how that developed.
Sure. Well, I really have an affinity for all things retro. And so whether it be from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and the music, I started listening, you know, when I was a kid, I was always listening to the old records. You know, my parents were older, so I really, you know, I loved listening to everything that they listened to. And, you know, I had several people in my family were musicians. I mean, my aunts, I had a lot of aunts in Rhode Island, and they loved singing. I had an uncle that used to gig out in the 40s, 30s, 40s. I had actually an uncle that moved to San Francisco who played saxophone. He had his own band, and then he played all through his life. And actually, that was the reason that I had covered I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
And, yeah, okay, and we'll talk, and we're going to listen to that in just a moment. You also have done some recording in Italian.
Yes, I have. I actually decided that because I love Italy, and obviously I am Italian, and I just love Italian music, and so I thought it would be really interesting to make a CD in Italian language and add some English songs, some English translations as well of those same songs on the CD for those that don't speak Italian.
Do you speak Italian?
My Italian is very poor, especially right now because obviously, you know, nobody can travel or anything. I went to Berkeley. I did Berkeley in Italy for a few different summers. I really loved that. But I do... I love being in Italy. I've been very fortunate to be able to have traveled to Italy several times. And that was, you know, definitely a reason behind my choice of making a CD to include the Italian music. I do perform at Italian festivals in our town. you know, they'd asked me to perform many times, and that's wonderful. I you know, it's great to be able to sing in Italian.
What part of Italy is your family from?
Well, my father is a Sicilian, and my mother is from Avellino. Her family's from Avellino. So, you know, I'm half Sicilian, and, you know, my mother's side being from Avellino. So it's southern Italy, so I guess you could say, yeah.
Well, why don't we take a listen to Set Up Heart of San Francisco? You know, that's a great old American songbook standard. But what did you do a little differently in your interpretation before we listen to it?
Well, sure. You know, we started obviously with the beginning, that beginning intro, you know, the loveliness of Paris,
right.
You know, that was good. I wanted to have that because I found that, you know, had a really nice, complement to the rest of the song. And then, Al Vega and I decided, you know, that he was going to play it in kind of a, almost a honky tonk sort of way. If you notice in the instrumental section, kind of, you know, he wanted kind of that little honky tonk piano vibe. I can't explain it because I'm not a pianist, but it was really interesting. And I wanted to also keep the elements of the original song, you know, stay true to the song, because I didn't want to, you know, it's such a classic song that I didn't want to destroy it by going crazy or anything. The musical style.
Well, let's just go ahead and take a listen to Left Your Heart in San Francisco with Valerie Giglio.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is for another day. Well, I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm coming home to my city.
And that was Valerie Gilo, and that was I Left My Heart in San Francisco. What a great American standard there.
Oh, completely. So, Valerie, we're going to add author to your list of singer, lawyer, and author. Now, the author came about for a very unusual, devastating circumstance. And your book is called Singing in My Own Key, A Vocalist's Triumph Over Stroke.
Yes.
And I know you've talked about this story a lot, but could you
In 2014, I had a what's called a vertebral artery dissection. And so I turned my neck. Then nobody knows why it happened. And I remember I just turned my neck when I was sleeping, and it broke the arteries in my neck. And so leading to my brain. And so then I walked around like that for a few days, you know, not knowing. And but I was in severe pain, neck pain. And then I had a brainstem stroke. Because what happens is, you know, when you break the arteries, obviously it causes, you know, they're broken. So then they cause a clot, and the clot just traveled to my brain, which it was his nearest neighbor right there. So I was, you know, I was completely paralyzed on my left side. I lost my singing voice. I completely, I lost my swallow. I lost a lot of different things. And I spent about two months or so in Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston. And I learned how to walk again. And then I was in therapy for about a year after that, outpatient therapy. And I had to just start all over again. And it was definitely devastating, very traumatic. You know, changed my whole life, changed in a moment. You know, I never would have thought, because I'm in perfect health. I think there's nothing wrong with me. And, you know, I just I had to learn how to sing again. From scratch. I couldn't do anything, nothing at all. I didn't have, and not even, it was, and the irony is that the night before the stroke, I was rehearsing for a 20th anniversary show, vocal showcase, called Chick Singer Night. They have different chapters all over the country, you know, featuring women singers. And I was at a rehearsal that day, and I didn't realize that I was having a stroke. I was really tired.
I read the beginning of your book, and it's just amazing how much pain and discomfort we take before we endure before we realize that it's something serious. But then you finally said it's serious, and even then you weren't diagnosed. So that must be, I know. And I read the part where you called 911 and even then you couldn't communicate, and they weren't understanding what was happening. That was like so frustrating to read, like you're in the hospital and you still can't communicate what's going on.
It was really stressful. Obviously very stressful for my whole family. But, you know, I made a almost complete recovery.
It's just miraculous.
And I got accepted to Berklee College of Music 2 years later. So my voice must have been okay for them. So, and I said, I want to go back to school. I want to change, you know, my whole direction. And I don't really focus on law too much anymore. I still practice, obviously, but I'm, you know, doing electronic music producing at Berklee College of Music. And it's been wonderful. I don't know if I'll be able to continue. It depends on the virus and the situation here. But I've learned so much. And also, I had an audio book, an audio version, which I decided to make using my own voice as a narrator, because I couldn't speak for more than a few sentences or even words at a time in the beginning. You know, I would, you know, be out of breath. I couldn't
even endurance.
Do that. Yeah, I had no endurance. So it meant a lot to me to be able to do that, and then to enter it into the Grammys under spoken word.
And that's where we met through the Grammy voting process. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you've moved on to sing after that. And one of your examples is a Duran Duran cover. Tell us a little bit about that, and we'll take a listen to it.
Sure. Okay. I decided that I wanted to completely rearrange Rio from Duran Duran in a jazz style. And I produced it myself because, you know, obviously this is something using the tools that I've learned, the skills I learned at Berklee. And I did this actually during the lockdown. So, you know, I added a little vibraphone because I started playing the vibraphone a little bit after.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and I added a teeny solo, you know, in there. And Yeah. So I wanted to make something very, very different with this.
Well, let's take a listen to Rio with Valerie Gigolo.
Bird of paradise, cherry ice cream smile, I suppose it's very nice. With a step to your left and a flick to the right, you catch the mirror way out west, and you know you're something special, and you look like you're the best. She dances on the sand, just like that river twisting through a dusty land. And when she shines, she really shows you all she can. Oh, Rio, Rio, dance across the Rio Grande.
Was a cover of Duran Duran's wonderful Rio with a jazz style. You know, asking you about the pandemic's going on, COVID-19, tell us a little bit how that's impacted you in terms of what you're doing both musically and that, and what you're looking forward to.
Well, okay. You know, it's been very, this is what I want to say about this. I know it is so stressful for everybody. It has given so much anxiety. I mean, I know myself, I mean, my gosh, it's like, makes you crazy almost. I mean, you just locked down in the house mostly. And because of my, you know, my conditions, I don't really want to go out too much. But I just want to say that, you know, after having a stroke, I had to stay in for almost a year. Maybe I only went out here and there. I did go to the Grammys in January, but that was really one of the only things that I had done. But, you know, we will get through this. We will get through this. And there really isn't a need for people to just, you know, I know it's so frustrating. I know. I get it. You know, you want to go out and do the things that you did before. But I just want to say that, you know, people will get through this. We will get through this. We are resilient, you know, our bodies and minds, we're resilient. So, you know, I've been there. I know how it is to not be able to leave the house. And I think there's always something to look forward to, and it's not going to be forever. And that's the important thing.
What plans?
Right. And we have the option to change directions too, as you might, yes. You know, as we transition to different things.
Yes.
Well, we have about a minute left here. So tell us what plans you have musically to down the road. What are you planning on working on?
I have a lot of musical plans. Actually, I'm developing this music it's called Binaural Beats and Isochronic Tones, just to almost like a meditation type of music, but not meditation, just basically to help people with anxiety and maybe lower your blood pressure, just relaxation music. But also performing, I'm getting into electro swing music, 1920s kind of vibe. So I have those two projects I'm working on, transitioning more to electronic music, just because I'm studying that at school, and I think it's a chance to be very creative. People like to downplay electronic music, but I don't think that they should at all, because you'd really be amazed at, you've got to know a lot about theory and a lot about music in general. And a lot about technology to be able to do that. So maybe I'm not playing an instrument, but the computer is my instrument. And so,
So what instruments do you play?
I play a little bit of ukulele and some vibraphone and obviously vocal, so singing. But I think, I'm willing to try any instrument. I love instruments. So. Thank you so much for having me on this show.
It's a real pleasure meeting you face to face after we've talked on the phone. And like I said, we came in contact with the Grammy FYC group and for your consideration. And so it's a real pleasure, Valerie. So quickly, your website is, you can hear you on SoundCloud.com, and your website is?
ValerieGilio.com, which it's a little bit of a work in progress at the moment. I'm just kind of editing it a little bit, but that's my website. And I'm on Apple Music and, you know, iTunes and Spotify and all those places. So
the book is on Amazon?
Yes, the book is on Amazon. The audio book is on there as well. So,
well, we appreciate that. Valerie Gilio is a wonderful vocalist, author, attorney, stroke awareness advocate, and we're so happy to have you on Art on the Air.
Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And now I'd like to welcome to Art in the Air, Gary Justice. He's a sculptor and photographer, does unique work, also is a professor, does much the thing. He's a mechanical motion, cause and effect action with that, and his photographies and videos are an extension and explorations of his sculpture. Gary, welcome to Art on the Air.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Aloha, Gary.
Well, Gary, first off, we'd like to hear just a little bit about your journey, how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Well, I could start at the beginning, I guess. I was born in Wichita, Kansas, and I was raised in a small town called Mays, Kansas, which was an agro-industrial town. And I grew up working agriculturally and also for my father's business, and I always had an interest in art. It was largely because of my mother, I believe, because she provided us with books growing up. And so we saw plenty of pictures of great art around the world. And so that interest carried over into college and later to grad school. I went to college at Wichita State University in Wichita, Kansas, and then I went to grad school in Chicago, Illinois. And I graduated there way back in the 70s and built my career there, and then eventually moved to Bloomington, Illinois, where I hold a professorship at Illinois State University.
Excellent. And that's
which artist in those beginning years captured your attention the most? Was it only paintings or?
No, it was sculpture as well. Michelangelo caught my attention. And of course, every kid growing up loved Leonardo, you know, for all kinds of reasons. And so we had our mutual admiration societies of those people amongst the boys and girls in my classes and so on and so forth.
One thing we'll talk about up front before we get into your art is how are you dealing with teaching as a professor with COVID-19? How's that working? Either online, distance learning, or, you know, and especially with sculpture, that has to be difficult. I mean, I assume you teach sculpture also.
Yes, I teach sculpture, and I teach a kinetics course in our arts and technology department as well. Dealing with that was pretty fluid for me because we had done the bulk of our assignments by the time we did the shutdown in April, and then we did online classwork, and that went pretty smoothly. I think the students were kind of antsy because they were, you know, stuck at home and so on and so forth. So Zoom meetings were very congenial and very productive. I also set up a page on Facebook for the students to have discussion and to post pictures of some of the assignments and so on and so forth. And I also posted, you know, articles that I thought were pertinent to the class. So that was a smooth transition for me. Now they're having to face a return in the fall, and I'm not part of that because I'm on sabbatical for that semester. And it was just by chance that I had applied for a sabbatical. So I'm fortunate in that sense because I can kind of be a spectator of, you know, the difficulties they are facing. So
in Kansas, was it a farm that you grew up on, or?
Well, we lived in town when I was a child, and then we eventually moved to the country. My father had a plumbing business, and he was a tradesman, and you know, but when you live rurally like that, most kids grow up working on farms and doing a lot of that hard labor, and you kind of develop a love for the topography and for that sort of way of life. So that was a big influence.
So is that, did you work with your father? I'm sort of trying to find the origin of where the sculpture and where the kinetic sculpture came from. Because I know, you know, I did projects with my family, which inspired a lot of my work. I was just wondering where the roots of yours lie.
Oh, yeah. That comes directly from my father. Mechanical problem solving, because he was not only a tradesman, but he was a kind of a wannabe engineer, and so he had projects that he would do after work that we would participate in. He would build different types of tools or gadgets or different types of strange automobiles, and so that's a huge influence.
What was the first projects you worked on together? Did he get involved in the art aspects or?
Well, the very first project we did together was to try and figure out my erector set when I was really young. And so he got me how to put a nut on a bolt, and then it was all over. He didn't have to show me anything else. I would work on those things until my fingers were raw. And I learned a lot through experimentation, making mistakes, hurting my fingers, and so on and so forth. But later on, he allowed myself and my brother to help him with various projects. And I was always, you know, the handier of the two.
It's such a good way to learn because young children can do complicated things if they're shown the proper way to do it. So that's wonderful that your dad was so involved.
Absolutely. He was, you know, we try his patience once in a while, but,
That's your job.
Yeah, that's our job. Yes.
It's a parent's job to try your patience. And it is, I know I had, but Flynn with the rector said I had one with a motor so I could do an elevator and things like that. It's a great experience working in three dimensions. So your academic career, you got a BFA and then an MFA, I believe?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I got an MFA from the School of the Art Institute. And it wasn't my intention to go into teaching, but teaching kind of found me. They offered me a few classes as an adjunct at the School of the Art Institute. Back in the 80s. And so I discovered that I had a talent for it. And so I accepted more classes as I came along, and I did better and better. And eventually I applied here and there and found other more permanent positions in Chicago. Before I moved here, I had an adjunct position at Northwestern University, which was a job I loved very much. Those people had called me and asked me to come and teach there, which was a real honor. And I taught there for about 7 years.
I'm interested in the Lens culture that you're part of. Can you explain what that's about online, what that is?
Well, Lens culture is it's a photographic platform for photographers to share their work and to enter international exhibitions where you can find your work more widely distributed. The shows are very competitive. There are literally tens of thousands of people who apply for those shows. But at the same time, Lens Culture provides you with a really nice website to display your work if you're part of their platform. And I found that to be really productive in a lot of other ways besides just applying for exhibitions.
Right. All types of work on there. I've been scanning through it real quickly here, but what types of work is it?
Well, yes, they do. As far as the relevance of my work, I think I'm kind of the odd man out because a lot of what they show, I think, are a little more conservative than what I put on the site. However, once in a while, I'll see a photographer who's more experimental, working with abstraction, with light, and so on and so forth. But I think we're pretty much in the minority on that platform. But it does, it helps one to educate oneself in what's going on in current photography trends and so on. So I think it's a valuable resource.
Tell us a little bit about your photography. I'm looking at it as very, somewhat abstract and experimental, and that's definitely a description, but how you come to that and maybe some of the tools you use to achieve it.
Yeah, that in a way, the process kind of found me because several years ago, my wife gave me a Canon SureShot camera, and I never had a decent camera in my life. This was a small palm-sized camera, but it took very good pictures. And at the time, she and I were doing experimental videos, animations, and so on and so forth. And I discovered that certain setups that we would photograph, they looked like figures to me, and they were purely made from projected light that were light that was projected through different optical apparatus, lenses, reflective papers, and so on and so forth. And I thought, you know, I could really explore this and make some analog setups and photograph them and then rework them in Photoshop and see what I came up with. So that was kind of the genesis. It came out of working in an experimentation with my wife on video things. Now, my setup is very simple. I have a small table, and some of the images I take are very small, and I magnify them. But light is a material that's just as mutable as almost any other material that you can imagine. To me, it's a sculptural material, so I'm able to kind of transmute it into different forms that actually look like 3D objects within a picture plane.
Well, my background is in theatrical lighting design, so I understand that about carving images on the stage, and that's my photography came to as a recording of that type of thing, both as a lighting designer and later as a director and producer. So I understand that my photography is much more traditional too, so it's not some of the experimental things you're doing.
I also suffer from the distraction of shadows myself, and so...
Well, shadows have substance in a way, you know. They do. You can do a lot with shadow. Well, it's all about light and shadow. So
I worked with a director who didn't quite understand that. He came from what I call the Las Vegas School of Directing for theatrical shows, and I said shadow is part of what it is. And I finally moved him to that when we did the Fantastics, the Center for Visual Performing Arts, where I use projections on the floor, what we call gobos. They walk in and out of shadows. They don't have to have their face full lit each time. It's like, so yeah, I kind of moved him there. So
I hope that was a revelation for him.
Yeah, I think so. I think he thought there was on page 45 of some book, all stage lighting is done this way for musicals. So.
So Gary, how did all the projected light and kinetic sculpture, when did that come together? Because those are so beautiful, because not only do you have the sculpture, but then you have everything that's going on the wall.
Yeah, those came fairly early in my career. Well, I started making light instruments in graduate school, and this would be in the mid-70s. Through the early 80s, I was always fascinated with motion, and to incorporate light into it gave me, another dimension. And I discovered that I could create form with the contrast between light and shadow, which is what you were just talking about with the theater. You see things by contrast. And so I was able to use a resource in Chicago, which was American Science and Surplus. They had
a wonderful
array of things that were very inexpensive, that were repurposed from government production, and you could use that as materials. And there was a huge array of lighting resources and electronics that I could use. So I just continued to experiment and build my career based on that. And so at the time I was doing kinetic work, there weren't that many kinetic artists in Chicago. So the work kind of found an audience right away, and I was very fortunate for that.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
So, Gary, you're so multi-talented, and you also do storytelling and everything, and I think you have a story that we were going to listen to called Giving It Up. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll take a listen to it.
Well, this is a story I wrote a number of years ago about the loss of my brother, and it it involves the love of objects and the love and devotion of family.
So we'll take a listen to Giving It Up by Gary Justice.
My brother Greg loved to torment me when we were little guys, but he never tormented me beyond the limits of our mom's ability to vanquish his evil designs. In the late 50s, before I entered grade school, we spent summers roaming the old neighborhoods of our little Kansas town. We were lucky to have parents who had created a network of neighbor informers, all seeing, all knowing, versed in all our past antics and troublemaking. Our parents knew our activities hours before we returned home for the evening. We had mixed feelings about the strange talent of our parents. In a way, we felt relief at the vigilance, knowing they could undo the injustice we felt being barred from other people's yards and pastures where we continually felt we had to explore. Yet we resented the breadth of their control. Those grown-up rules dismantled the best of our malevolent intentions and secret adventures. In our town, people would burn their yards in the autumn, on the theory it would produce next year's perfect yard. We came upon a burnt yard one bright morning, my brother said. If you touch that black stuff, you will die. He pulled me away from the curb at the yard's edge. I remember looking at him and crossing my eyes. Nuh-uh, he smirked. It happened over in Colwich, dipstick. A kid dried up and broke in half in 5 minutes. I looked at the yard and felt extreme fear. After all, he was my brother, and he knew a lot of stuff. A moment later, I felt a sudden shove, and I slammed face first into the charred lawn. I remember the cool feeling of the blood leaving my face. I'm gonna die! I'm gonna die! The neighbors across the street reported later how they saw my feet as a blur as I streaked home, doomed to shriveled up, vivisectioned oblivion. My mom calmed me down in her long embrace. My brother told that story up until 2006. He drew a laugh from so deep inside his soul, I thought the joy of those moments would carry us past any heartache, through infinite sorrows, and back again to share some more ancient adventures. In 1958, my dad took me to the movies to see The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. I was electrified at the effects, which were antiquated by today's standards, of course, but still charming. There was a chilling presence of the genie who lived in a strange metallic oil lamp. I remember the genie looked a little like Mr. Clean, and I wondered if they were brothers. Later that afternoon, my dad cut out a facsimile of a magic lamp from plywood, and we painted it together. Even though it was flat and had no interior, I would rub this lamp for minutes, then hours, hoping for the miracle of the genie and his three wishes. I had a lot of kid issues, so I figured I could fit all my wishes into three main categories. Number one, make my brother leave me alone. Number two, give me my brother's cool toys. Number three, please make Superman live in my room. When my brother saw me rubbing the lamp, he snickered. Hey, dipstick, you're not rubbing hard enough anyway. That's not how you get the genie to come out. Don't you know what ectoplasm is? I rubbed more ferociously. Then I asked, how do I get him to come out? I'm not giving that secret up, but you may as well give it up. No, you give it up. Give it up, turd brain, he said, imitating my rubbing gestures as he turned to go out our back door into the yard. I yelled at him, no, no, you give it up. By now I was beginning to cry, screaming after him, wanting to knock his head off. Despite my childish wishes, the darn genie never did come out, and eventually the lamp passed into the darkness of the basement storage room. My brother went on to be a very successful Northern Michigan lawyer. The years of our young and middle adulthood were grand in friendship and constant contact. He raised a family, defended folks who were poor, and did community work, always putting family first. I can never remember a time that my brother was afraid of anything. He was threatened constantly by unenlightened folks, usually angry spouses from divorce cases, or wealthy, self-important litigants who saw my brother as a crusader. Regardless of the dangers, I saw him stand like a rock in any situation. Years later, I realized that the real Superman from my childish wish list already lived in our house years ago. In our town of Bloomington, I found a great life with LJ, my dear wife. A parade of pet Dobermans passed in and out of our years together. My brother continued a brilliant career in the North, visiting us a few times a year, and always sending deep, soulful emails and letters. Life can be so right sometimes, so perfect, it seems like it could fill the whole of one's existence. I was mowing my yard on a mild June day in 2006 when I received a call from my brother's second son. Uncle Gary, I heard him say on my cell phone. Dad had a heart attack. He's gone. The ground jumped up. I bent down to brush away the freshly cut grass from my shoes, and the world went away. Several months had passed when I visited my mom in Kansas. I was grateful to find that same old plywood lamp Dad and I made in the 50s. It was in a box of things in Mom's basement. All the other objects in the box were crapped out beyond belief, but the lamp lay there, immaculate. It's a work of art now, almost 50 years old. I guess that makes it an antique, or at least a piece of folk art. The lamp is a great artifact for the wall in our kitchen now. We have it hanging with some other treasures. One cool sunny morning, I decided to photograph it. The lamp made me think of my brother and all the torment of our youth that eventually turned to adult understanding and admiration. I took out my camera and waited for the eastern sun to peek over the houses outside our kitchen window. I placed the lamp on a metal stool across from the window. As the morning light grew in intensity, I fastened my camera to a tripod and focused the image of the lamp in the viewfinder. The sun suddenly lit the room with an intensity I had never seen before. Light was beaming through a crystal vase that was positioned on the windowsill, illuminating the walls with sharp, intense blades of light. The projections contained a rich spectral color and seemed to pulsate from the sun dance projected through the outside trees. I'd never seen a transmission of light and color this intense, dancing, moving in unison as the sun ascended. I looked into the viewfinder as the projections seemed to culminate in one intense blade of light and color. I positioned the lamp, turning it for the best angle, and something seemed to stop my hand. I saw an explosion of blistering light and intense hues at the tip of the lamp's spout. I rubbed my eyes, and the scene was still there. The lamp seemed to spew pure energy. a long, slightly curved stream of searing light and dancing colors. My God, I thought. Ectoplasm. It was my brother, my hero, giving it up. I stumbled, caught myself, then I settled back to watch the miracle of the day.
That was Giving It Up with Gary Justice. Excellent. That was just wonderful, Gary.
Well, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about any future projects you have coming up. We have about 2 minutes or so left here in the interview, but tell us about what you're looking forward to maybe doing that you haven't done yet, and also how COVID-19's affected you.
Well, COVID's kept me at home and on the computer, so I've been entering the international photography shows, and I was recently awarded Juror's Choice in this show to be shown in Barcelona.
Congratulations on that. That's so fabulous.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled about it. And that will happen in August.
Could you share our websites, how people can view your work and how to get in touch with you, maybe if you're looking for a commission or something?
Well, yes, I have quite a bit of work up on Artsy now. You can simply go to Artsy and put in my name, Gary Justice, J-U-S-T-I-S. I also have a website of my photography. www.garyjusticephotography.com.
Well, we appreciate you being on Art on the Air. That's Gary Justice. He's a sculptor of, I guess you might say, cause and effect actions and machinery, also photographer, videographer, and a professor. Thank you so much for being on Art on the Air.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Gary.
And we'd like to thank our guests today for being on Art in the Air, which is heard every Friday at 11 a.m., rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m., and Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president, radio operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and Walt Breininger of Paragon Investments. Also, Mary Levan is our art patron supporter. Art in the Air is supported by the Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at artontheair@gmail.com. That's artontheair@gmail.com. See you right here next week, 103.1 FM and 89.1 FM, Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther. I'm not.